Good evening, everyone. You know, if we are very honest, there are a lot of things that we get wrong about the birth of Jesus. It's not that we don't care about the facts. We just seem to kind of lose them in the mix of the sentimentality and the retelling of a story that is very, very precious to us. As well-intentioned as we may be, there are lots of questions that a good Bible student will begin to ask when they look at the birth of Jesus. And they'll find out that things are not quite as we have told it. And so we're going to spend some time tonight in our section that we call Bible Questions and Bible Answers. And we're going to look at some of the things that surround the birth of Jesus that are not quite the way we have heard it. And we're going to try to understand from the Bible some of those things that are there and some of the answers that we have. Now, there are a lot of different things we can look at, but specifically, we're going to look at the time of year that Jesus was born. We're going to look at the place where he was born. We're going to look at Mary's arrival in Bethlehem, and we're going to talk about the Magi. And those are the things we're going to try to talk about tonight. Now, I'm not going to give you, a super long lesson tonight, but I am wanting us to use the scriptures and try to piece things together. Because some of these questions, some of these answers to the questions that, of the surrounding events will really set somebody on their ear if they are not really focused on what the Bible itself says. The first thing we need to focus on is the time of year when Jesus was born. Now, we have had for, it seems like forever, the idea that Jesus was born on December the 25th, and we've got all kinds of things that have been taught for years and years and years, ever since the second century. In the second century, the idea of Jesus being born on the 25th of December was established by a second century theologian by the name of Hippolytus. And he argued that this was the date of the birth of Jesus. Now, what's interesting is that in the second century, when they began that declaration and began to celebrate Jesus' birth on December 25th, the Eastern Church, and by that time there had been a split between the Western and Eastern Church, the Eastern Church said, no, December 25th is not the date of Jesus' birthday. His birth occurred on January the 6th. So, Sam, if they're right, then you were not born on Christmas Day, because you were born on December 25th. But in reality, both of them are probably wrong. And when we say something like that, almost immediately you're going to have people who, when you broach this kind of subject, who are really very emotional about the attachment to December 25th as the day of the birth of Jesus. In fact, it is in spite of the facts, they will say, no, it had to be the 25th of December that Jesus was born. And they'll do that because they enjoy the season, they enjoy the feel that the actual date of Christ's birth is especially relevant, so that they see mankind actually centering and ordering their lives around the birth of Jesus. But biblical students should be aware that there are some very strong proofs that Jesus was not born on the 25th of December. Now, one thing that ought to argue about having a specific date like the 25th of December is the fact that the Jewish people did not use the same kind of calendar that we use. they used a lunar calendar. And so in using a lunar calendar and transferring it over into our kind of calendar of a solar calendar, you're going to find that the date of something will change by several weeks every year. And so one of the things that we've got to keep in mind, I mean, that's why Easter changes every year. Because Easter is based on the time frame of Easter, Passover for the Jews is based on the Jewish lunar calendar, and when you translate the lunar calendar into the solar calendar, it fluctuates. It's not that the date is different, it's just that the date as it applies to a solar calendar would be different. You would have the same sort of phenomena with regard to the date of a birth as well under a lunar calendar. But pushing that aside, are there some things that tell us about the birth? On the surface, the accounts of Matthew and Luke reveal very little about the time of Jesus' birth. No dates are given. No season of the year is named. A well-regarded historian, Luke, provides us, though, with a sound, orderly account of events that should remove any doubt as to the general time of Jesus' birth. And all the clues are there, and all that's required is for us to play Sherlock Holmes for just a little while, dig them out, put them in order to discover the truth. So, we're gonna look at the section of Luke's Gospel, that the long section that begins in chapter 1, verse 5, and goes all the way to chapter 2 in verse 8. And Luke writes about a series of specific events, and he writes them in chronological order. Okay? And he begins by telling the story of Zacchaeus. That's like I did this morning when I mentioned that Jesus was a Nazarite. He wasn't a Nazarite, he was a Nazarene. And I almost everybody caught it except me when I said it. But anyway, Zacharias, a priest, and his wife, Elizabeth, who were childless. And in Luke chapter 1, it tells us that Zechariah was visited by the angel Gabriel while administering his priestly duties during the course of Abijah. During the course of Abijah. Now, when he says that, that's an important clue. Because when he says Abijah, the course of Abijah is important, then that's something we need to put aside and say, well, what does that mean exactly? And then we find out that as you skim on down through the text, you're going to find out that it's in the sixth month of Elizabeth's pregnancy that Gabriel, the same angel that visited Zechariah, visits Mary, informs her that she will conceive in her womb and bring forth a son, and you're going to call his name Jesus. And that immediately right after that, Mary goes to visit her cousin Elizabeth and stay with her until the latter's ninth month, leaving just prior, according to Luke's account, just prior to the birth of John. Jesus then was born approximately six months after John was born. So what information do we have up to this point? Well, up to this point, we know that Zacharias, a priest, performed his duties during the course of Abijah. After he returned home from Jerusalem, Elizabeth conceived. Mary conceived in the sixth month of Elizabeth's pregnancy, and John was born approximately 6 months before Jesus. Now, to date Jesus' birth, we need to have a starting point. And Luke supplies that starting point in verse 5 of Luke chapter 1, when he says when he mentions the course of Abijah. Is it possible for us to know if this course existed then and when it fell during the year and how long it lasted? At Absolutely, it is possible. 1 Chronicles chapter 24 lists the courses, the divisions, or the shifts of the priesthood that served in the temple throughout the year. Verse 1 states that these are the divisions of the sons of Aaron. And among the sons of Eleazar were 16 heads of their father's house, while among the sons of Ithamar were 8 additional heads of house, making 24 courses, according to verse 4 of 1 Chronicles chapter 4. Now, these courses of priests were divided by lot to be officials of the sanctuary and of the house of God, according to verse 5. Beginning on Nisan, the first day of Nisan, these courses rotated throughout the year, serving in the temple for 1 week apiece. The course of Abijah, the course during which Zacharias was responsible to work, was the 8th shift. Okay? Now Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, who was, by the way, of the priestly lineage of the course of Jehoiarib, the first course, supplies some further information. This is what he says. He says, he, David, divided them also into courses, and when he had separated the priests from them, he found these priests, 24 courses, 16 of the house of Eleazar, 8 of that of Ithamar, and he ordained that one course should minister to God during 8 days, from noon Sabbath to noon on the following Sabbath. And thus were the courses distributed by lot in the presence of David and Zadok and Abathar the high priest, and all the rulers. And that course which came up first was written down on the first, and accordingly the second, and so on to the 24th, and this partition hath remained to this day. Alright? Now that's Josephus writing, and he's writing in the first century, and those courses were strictly followed until the temple was destroyed in AD 70. And the Talmud describes the details of the rotation of these courses beginning on the first day of the month of Nisan. With only 24 courses, obviously each course is required to work twice a year, leaving 3 extra weeks. The Hebrew year normally had 51 weeks, except for a leap year, which had an additional 4 weeks. The 3 holy days, Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles, during which the courses were the 3 weeks during which all the courses were required to serve. So there's your 3 extra weeks, okay? So each of them worked 5 weeks out of the year. 2 in their specific courses, and 3 during the festivals of Passover, Pentecost, and the Feast of Tabernacles. John the Baptist was sent to prepare the way for the Messiah, according to Malachi 3 and verse 1, according to Luke chapter 1, 13 through 17. And the gospel makes it clear that he was born about half a year before Jesus was born. And now, from these historical records, what do we find out? Well, we find out this. We find out that Zacharias, of the course of Abijah, worked in the 9th week in his assigned course and the 10th week in the Pentecost course. And this period ran from the month of Iyar through Sivan in the Hebrew calendar. Or, if you put it into a solar calendar, from June 3rd through the 17th. That was when his course was, June 3rd through the 17th. He probably returned home after his shift was completed, and Elizabeth most likely conceived sometime in the next 2-week period, somewhere between June 18th through July 1st. With that information, we can calculate Elizabeth's 6th month. Her 6th month would be December, which would be the month that Mary conceived. And it's possible, because of the circumstances shown in Luke 1, that Mary conceived during the last 2 weeks of Elizabeth's 6th month. Thus, John is born in the spring, probably between March 18th and the 31st. And by projecting forward another 6 months to Jesus' birth, the most probable time for his birth occurs between September 16th and September 29th. Now, an interesting sidelight about all of this is that during that time period, September 16th through the 29th, falls one of the three great feasts, the Feast of Tabernacles. And John says, literally, in John chapter 1, when he says, "The Word became flesh and dwelt among us," the words that he used, he says, "The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us." So it seems like there's a pretty good bit of evidence here that Jesus was probably born during the week of the Feast of Tabernacles. During the week of the Feast of Tabernacles in the month of September. Now, there's some additional proof that Jesus was born in the fall of the year. The census of Quirinius that required Joseph to travel from Galilee to Bethlehem would most probably have taken place after the fall harvest, when people were more able to return to their ancestral homes, as we read in chapter 2 of Joseph doing. And it's customary, it was customary at that time in Judea to do all the tax collecting during that period of time, as the bulk of a farmer's income came at that time. And so we find that it's logical for Joseph to have made his trip for tax purposes in response to the decree from Caesar Augustus that he go down and register at his ancestral home. It's logical that this occurred during the fall season. Another point is that Joseph and Mary had to find shelter in some place else other than an inn, other than a guest house. And the shelter that they had to find, now the text will say something about being in a stable or a barn or something like that. But in reality, most likely, the place that they would have stayed would have been one of the shepherd's holds out in the fields. Because you see, Bethlehem was the center of the keeping of the flocks of sheep that were used in the temple sacrifices. And there were, in the hills around Bethlehem, numerous caves that had been enlarged in some cases, but were being used and had been used for a good long time as places where, during the fall months, when they have rain and changes of weather, they could go and take care of their animals while they're out in the fields. And of course, what we read in verse 8 that the shepherds were still in their fields with their flocks. Jesus' birth could not therefore have occurred during the cold weather months of winter, because sheep were normally brought into a centrally located pen or corral area as the weather turned colder and the rainy season began. But they would be out there in the fields, and there would be places in the hills that they could be taken at a moment's notice if something unexpected came up. Now, why would Luke have mentioned it in such detail if it were not important for us to understand in terms of conveying a time reference? I think he wouldn't. I think he mentions these things as a time reference so that we can begin to understand. And that also helps us understand why there's no room in the inn. Although even that, there is something there that I was unaware of until I began doing some more study. Joseph and Mary didn't go to the cave, may not have gone to the cave or to the stable area, because the local inn was completely out of rooms. Although the time period makes it very feasible that that's probably the case, because this is the time of the Feast of Tabernacles. But one argument against that is that during the time period of the Feast of Tabernacles, everybody is supposed to build an outside shelter and stay there. Which means that the inn that would be full during Passover, that would be full during Pentecost, may not have had anybody staying inside because they should have been building their own tabernacle to stay outside. But there's a, if you'll take a look, turn with me to Luke chapter 2. Luke chapter 2, look at, with me at verses 4 through 7. Okay? Let's read carefully what's here. Even in the English, it's possible for us to understand what is being stated. Joseph also went up from Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth, into Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed wife, who was with child. So it was that while they were there, the days were completed for her to be delivered, and she brought forth her firstborn son, and wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. Now, it seems pretty straightforward in English that they're saying, hey, the hotel is full. There's a no vacancy sign out. But in the Greek, it literally says, for them, there was no place in the inn. That's a little bit different, isn't it? For them, there was no place in the inn. It's not as clear as the time clues for the time of year and all of that, but it does indicate that perhaps what is going on here is that there was some stigma attached to Mary and Joseph showing up. Because, you see, the inn that is described there in the Greek language has a very specific association. It refers to a family guest room. And in fact, it does not refer to an establishment like Motel 6 where they leave the light on. It does not refer to Howard Johnson or anything like that. It refers to a very common practice of the first century world, of the Jewish population especially, with regard to providing places for people to stay during these festivals where people flocked to Jerusalem and participated in Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles, but especially Passover and Pentecost. Bethlehem is located just a short distance away from Jerusalem. It would be very possible for them to stay in Bethlehem, go travel into the city, do their worshiping there and come back and stay. And what was going on in this time period was that these people would go to where their ancestral home was, and there would be built and provided places where the family could stay. A family inn, if you will, a family guest room. If that's the, and that's the word that Luke specifically uses. It's translated in, but it means family guest room. It's a place built specifically for family members to stay at during these festivals. And if that's the case, and we read it as it literally is, for them there was no place in the family guest room, it's telling us they weren't allowed. Not that there was no room. There was no room for them in the family guest room. Now, that's important for us to consider that. While we can't really be super dogmatic about it, that helps us understand that Jesus, at his birth, could very well have already begun experiencing the very things that we experience in our life, including things like discrimination and hate and just people not dealing with you in a proper manner. Now, that's one of the things that we see about Jesus in his there. Another one that's kind of fun is that we always, as we tell the story, we always have Mary riding into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey. Every movie that's ever made has her riding on the back of a donkey. If you look in the text, there's no place where a donkey is ever mentioned. Now, I mention that simply because donkeys and camels are expensive. And walking was the common mode of transportation of the day. And while we might say, hey, this is a 9-month pregnant lady. She's not going to walk from Nazareth to Bethlehem. They probably would have said, you've got to walk. We don't know. But I just want to point out, Mary is never pictured in Scripture as either riding on a donkey or a camel. She's not pictured as that. She simply tells us that she arrived there. The next thing that we want to look at is the Magi. The Magi. Now, the Magi don't show up with the shepherds at the manger. In fact, if you take a look at Matthew chapter 2 and verse 11, you'll find out that they don't show up until much later. Matthew 2 verse 11 says, when they had come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary his mother and fell down and worshipped him. They saw the young child, all right? And they fell down and worshipped him. And I lost the page. There it is. All right. Now, a couple of things here. Number one, Jesus is not referred to now as a baby or an infant. He's referred to as a young child. Number two, as we look at the things that happen later on in verse 16, Herod, who has been informed by the Magi about the birth, is upset. And so he sends soldiers down to Bethlehem to kill all the young male children who fit into that age range. The word child is a word that talks about someone between the ages of about 6 months to 2 years. So we're looking, with this time clue in the vocabulary of Matthew, we're looking at Jesus and Mary and Joseph all being there in Bethlehem, probably at a minimum of 6 months. That gives them time to have made a trip to Bethlehem and from Bethlehem to Jerusalem for the circumcision and come back and to set up roots and sit down roots and things like that. And so Jesus is not a baby. The picture of the wise men arriving on the same night that Jesus is born, seeing him in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger, is not the same thing. By this way, we also don't have the names or even the number of these Magi. It wasn't until the 6th century that that someone in the 6th century gave these men names. Now, the names associated with them were Gaspar, Melchor, and Balthazar. These were the alleged names, and they were changed from being Magi to being kings. We three kings of Orient are. You know, that's the song. They're referred to as Magi. They're not referred to as kings. All we know is that there were Magi, plural, and that they brought three gifts: gold, frankincense, and myrrh. We don't know how many there are. And then there's another problem about Magi, a problem that a lot of people today are really focusing on, and that is, what does the word Magi mean? They followed a star, some modern translators and modern scholars are saying, well, that must mean that these were astrologers. And they were puzzled some of these people have been puzzled then by the fact that Jesus was allowed to accept gifts from astrologers. Because in Deuteronomy 17, God commands his people to execute all astrologers by stoning. Because trying to determine the future by reading the stars was forbidden by God. And so the argument by some is apparently that these were astrologers following a star, and this is actually Satan at work, and we shouldn't have anything to do with it. There's a much simpler explanation. And all we have to do is go back to the book of Daniel. In the book of Daniel, Daniel was referred to as being the chief of the Magi in Nebuchadnezzar's court. Now, Daniel, all through the book, totally pushes aside anything that would have alienated him from God. He was not an astrologer. A magi is someone who has a great deal of influence, and his influence, it carries into both religious and political realms. But the influence they have comes about because they've demonstrated themselves to be men who were wise. That's all that magi means. Men who are wise. And in fact, there is some evidence, some exterior evidence, that Daniel, reading through the prophecies of Isaiah, knew that there was a star to be predicted, informed the magi who were underneath him during his lifetime that this was coming. He himself had received a timetable that was going to delineate when approximately this was going to take place. And evidently, the thinking of some of these scholars is that these magi were acting on knowledge passed down to them from Daniel. And in fact, the treasure that had been brought may indeed have been treasure left by Daniel for the Messiah. These wise men were seeking him because they were following the lead of Daniel. Now, what does all of this tell us? Well, it tells us that there were a lot of things that maybe we have really not gotten right. And that there's a lot more to the story than we have ever really thought. And in fact, it tells us that the story of Jesus is a very powerful testimony to the amazing obedience of two very simple people who are willing to risk everything to honor God. And it tells us of how God made plans for their provisions centuries before, through the prophet Daniel. And so, one of the things we can begin to see is that none of this happened by accident. Everything happened according to the plan of God. Everything happened so that Jesus could fulfill his role. Everything occurred because Jesus had to be born where he was born and when. This evening, maybe we have a better appreciation for what occurs here. Not all the questions have been answered, but many of them have at least got explanations that help enlarge our view of just how intricate the plans of God were. But more than anything else, we begin to see, even at his birth, Jesus had to deal with things that are of the same kind of things we have to deal with. The injustice, the unkindness, the hate, the hostility of people. He had to deal with them, and he did deal with them, so that he could be the answer for us. This evening, let's encourage one another as we follow this Jesus. And if you're not yet a Christian, we want to encourage you. I'm about to lose my voice for some reason. We want to encourage you to follow Jesus all the way to the cross, be baptized into his death, raised to walk in newness of life, while together we stand and sing.